therefore her duties of introducing our audience fall upon my head. And we have with us today students from Pacelli High School. So will those students please rise? Very good. And as much as Pacelli is my alma mater, I'm very happy to see them. You may sit down. Are there any other schools present? Okay, so let me introduce, please allow me to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated on her right is Justice Patrick Trucks. To his right is Justice John Wilcox, Justice Bill Babbage. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on my far right is Justice David Prosper. With that being said, I will call the next case for oral argument, case number 00-1825, Alma Bicknies versus Thomas Satula et al. Counsel.
My name is Michael Fox, and I am the attorney representing Dr. Alma Bicknies, along with attorney Mary Canelli, who was the attorney who represented Dr. Bicknies at trial. We are here because Dr. Bicknies, a pediatric neurologist who was then working at the University of New York, Stony Brook, was offered a faculty appointment at the University of Wisconsin in order to induce her to decline the offer of a faculty appointment she had with the University of New York at Buffalo. On reviewing this record, I was struck a little bit by the irony of the posture of this case. What struck me is that the factual defense to this case at trial was that Dr. Satula didn't make the offer, and that indeed he could not have made the offer, because if he had done what the plaintiff said he did, he would be violating university policies that direct him to make offers only in a certain way. And those university policies are referred to in our brief. Section 7.03 of the faculty appointments said faculty appointments shall be offered only in accordance with the provisions of UWS 3.03 and these regulations, and with appropriate administrative approval. Section 3.03 prescribes the right, or prescribes the way the faculty appointments have to be made. One has to be given a salary, starting date, ending date, general position responsibilities, probation, and tenure status. The testimony at trial was that these were the responsibilities that Dr. Satula had, and if you believe Dr. McNeese's side of the case, he did not fulfill those specific responsibilities. But ironically, that defense was raised as a factual defense at trial, and after it was found that he did what Dr. McNeese alleged he had done, the secondary defense fell into place that he had discretionary immunity to do it. Now, this is an unusual case.
In this case, this is my question would be, was there a little, is this fall in the area of puffery or anticipated results? I'm talking about what Satula had talked to your client about, and indicated, well, he wouldn't have any problem with the committee. In other words, was that puffery on his part?
No. You're saying there's an absolute guideline, they have to stay within it.
His duty is absolute and imperative. He cannot puff. And that puffery that you refer to, and you are accurate, Justice Wilcox, in referring to, predated this critical moment where she was in communication with him and said, I have a job at the University of Buffalo. I will take that job unless I know for certain that this faculty appointment is going to be offered to me. It was at that moment he said it was.
Also, what do you believe are the issues before the court today in this case?
Well, the two critical issues are whether or not more is needed than the facts and the rules applicable to this case to create a ministerial duty. We've argued that more is not needed, that indeed the directives under which Dr. Satula had a function were much clearer than any other case where a discretionary immunity has been found. And secondly, there is some trouble about another exception to the discretionary immunity rule, which is that conduct need to be willful, wanton, or excuse me, intentional, willful, and malicious, or if it is a qualitative difference, intentional, willful, or malicious. We feel that we prevail on both of those issues in terms of overcoming discretionary immunity, and that's what I believe to be before the court.
I believe the state, in its brief, indicates in the alternative, kind of spends about a page and a half arguing on page 19 and 20, perhaps more than that. 22. Alternatively, if the complaint sounds in contract not toward Dr. McNeese did not establish the conditions precedent to sue the university in contract. Is that an issue?
Well, that is an issue that is raised late. We would contend that that issue is not before the court, that at best that issue was waived. It was never raised prior to the time this case was postured before the Court of Appeals. I suppose that the conditions precedent can be waived by the state under circumstances such as this, and we would argue that if it is an issue before this court, waiver would be appropriate.
I thought the rule was that sort of a defense cannot be waived. That's the Ibrahim case, is it not?
Well,
and can be raised at any time. It's a non-waivable jurisdictional defense of the Mason claim statute.
Well, there is that's correct, and we, in that sense, we filed a notice of claim in this case. The notice of claim was on file, and we made all of the allegations in the notice of claim, under the notice of claim statute. I think that's what that case dealt with, which was the notice of claim statute.
You filed that with the Attorney General?
We did.
In a timely fashion?
We did.
So that's an issue. Personal jurisdiction, our subject matter jurisdiction is not before us.
I don't believe so.
Then what about the personal jurisdiction matter? Did you file a claim with the legislature?
We did not.
But your position is that that can be?
My position is it can.
As opposed to the question of subject matter jurisdiction?
That's correct. Personal jurisdiction, I believe, always can be made. And subject matter jurisdiction cannot, and I think Justice Sykes is absolutely right in correcting me that with regard to the notice of claim statute, I believe the rule is clear. Cannot be waived.
Counsel, as following that, I'm not sure you are prepared to address that since you didn't see the sort of presentation in your brief. One of the earlier cases that we're dealing with here is the Lister case, Lister versus Board of Regents. And going with the defendant sounds pretty familiar for this case, Board of Regents. And in that case, I don't think the state was named as Is it fatal if the state isn't named as a party in your case? Let me ask you this. We need the state to be named as a party in this case. There's an argument in the concurrence that, hey, this is a contract action and it's really against.
I don't think it is fatal. And this is the reason. The state functions as an indemnity in this country, in the situation where we have brought this claim. They have to cover the liability of an individual actor who acts individually to commit the kind of tort or quasi-tort for which we have brought a claim.
They can be immune. I mean, I don't think any of our questions are addressed to Dr. Satula. I think our questions are addressed as the Board of Regents, as the party properly before us. As we think we said in the history that we have sovereign immunity.
I think that's correct, but I don't think the Board of Regents has to be before you as a named party. I mean, all of these claims against individual state actors, they are brought against the actors. And indeed, Section 893.82, which talks about the prerequisites for bringing claims against actors who commit torts, specifically excludes mention of the state as an actor itself. Suing the state as an actor itself would require a different set or a different approach and different responsibilities under 893.82, wherein the legislature has given the right of individuals to sue a state official under certain circumstances. Specifically, does not refer to the state as a party. It refers to the individual actor. That is the person that must be named in the notice. The Board of Regents. Board of Regents need not be named in the notice or the state itself. And in fact, it would be probably a surplusage to do so. What appears to be unique about this case, and getting to the issue of discretionary immunity, is that we have something rarely before the court in dealing with this thorny issue. That is that we have a trial. We have a fleshing out of the facts in the trial, and we have specific findings by a jury. First of all, there is no question that this case differs from, say, Kirsten, in that the actor who was being pursued for the tortious conduct that we allege is somebody fully with the authority and fully with the responsibility to make the representations that were made. We have deliberate conduct in this case. The deliberate conduct is that the jury found that Dr. Satula made representations, intended to make them, and intended to make them so that the actor would rely upon them. And in this case, when that actor relied upon them, his representation essentially exacted a tax from Dr. Bickneys. The tax was that opportunity that she said she would forego if she was offered the university job, and that's exactly the opportunity she lost. So it isn't the ordinary situation where somebody is making a representation, there's no necessary consequence or intended consequence that will follow. It's one where a definite consequence was intended and a definite consequence occurred. We also have something about the ordinary intended conduct here. We have a jury that found that when he made this representation, he was in reckless disregard of the truth, a higher standard than ordinary negligence, a higher standard than ordinary accidental conduct. He was found by that jury to have engaged in reckless conduct, specifically a reckless disregard for the truth. Perhaps this is what troubled the trial judge when he was faced with motions after verdict, and he suggested that the rule of the exception that what discretionary immunity was intended to be at one point in the law has now swallowed the rule of liability. And he worried about that and suggested this was an improper result. This case is different from those leading cases which this court has addressed in the past. Specifically, there was a comparison to Barilari. why this case is different than Barilari, because in Barilari, as we recall, there was an offer, a police officer indicated he was going to arrive at a certain spot, he was going to protect a certain individual, that he did not carry out that task in a way that did protect the individual, and the individual sued. So there was some notion of reliance in that particular case, which was used as an analogy to the situation here. Yes, sir.
Where I have a question with your case is this, on the merits. We have held in the past that if there's a ministerial duty to act, and you're saying that there was a ministerial duty, we have said that the subject matter of their action imposed specific legal obligations on the owner in which Dr. Satula was acting. What are those specific legal obligations? I'm having a difficult time distinguishing, my question goes, the fact that I am having a difficult time distinguishing this case from Kirsten, in which the majority said, I think they might have said that there was a ministerial duty here, but there was no specific legal obligation.
And I think that's an excellent point, and I hope I can address it squarely. I intended to do that when I opened here. The specific legal obligation he had, there are a couple. One is that he testified he was specifically responsible for setting the 10-year clock and doing so accurately in accordance with university rules. University rules provide that unless there is a petition, that Dr. McNeese would have only a 3-year tenure clock. Well-defined, he admits that's his duty. He admits the regulations defining how he is to carry out that duty are clear. He didn't carry it out as directed in those regulations. He misrepresented that she had a 5-year tenure clock in her pocket, and that was what induced her to take the job. But secondly, and even more clearly, it says that faculty appointments shall be offered only in accordance with the provisions of 3.03, and these regulations, and with appropriate administrative approval. He couldn't have a more specific directive than that. He didn't do it. He didn't have administrative approval when he offered this job. He did not have, as Section 303 requires, a definite tenure clock in mind. So he did not provide an offer in the manner he was directed to. He just offered. So I believe that differentiates this case from Kirsten. In Kirsten, we had a number of problems. One was that this was a mid-level government functionary who was providing information to an individual inquirer who made a phone call, who didn't have a duty to make a statutory interpretation at the time. So there was a lack of specific direction as to what the potential defendant would do in Kirsten, and the individual in Kirsten didn't have the authority to interpret statutes, and nor did the individual have the duty to do that. We have exactly the opposite situation here. We have clear directives from university rules policies that are set forth according to the administrative code. We have him with the authority, unlike the defendant in Kirsten, and we also have, by his own testimony, Dr. Satula having the duty to carry out his activity precisely as it's laid out here in the rules.
When I think of ministerial duty, I think of that definition that we see over and over again that started in Lister. And I don't have it right in front of me, but that it deals with the ministerial duty is so certain in time, mode, method, that leaves nothing to discretion. What was so certain here, assuming that I paraphrased it correctly, what was so certain here or definite with regard to time?
What was so definite is that the rules define the moment of offer and how it can be made and how it must be made.
The rules
define the moment. guide him at the moment he makes an offer. It said, when you make the offer, it can only be made in this way. So the time was the timing he set. He set the timing as certain. He chose that time. He didn't have to make it at that particular time, but whenever he chose to make it, he had to make it in accordance with the rules.
When you say, you're referring to the 703 rule?
I am, where it says faculty appointments shall be offered only in accordance with the provisions of UWS. He cannot make them in violation of that provision. If he chooses to make the offer, then he must make it as he's directed to make it. And that...
I'm looking, Council, at perhaps we're not on the same. Maybe talking about one of the subsections of 704.
I'm talking about 7.03 sub C.
7.03 sub C.
Council.
What I have is each person to whom an appointment is offered must receive an appointment letter. Is that what you're talking about?
No, the...
Right. I'm talking about Appendix 60 in our... Our appendix, which has 7.03 sub C.
It's not what you have read to me. That was not what I was referring to.
Your answer to Justice Bradley presupposes that this was an offer. But as I understand the facts, the... so-called offer came on a white sheet without any letterhead, and the purpose being that it was not an official offer from the university, but was essentially in anticipation that one might be made. How do you...
That wasn't the finding of the jury, and that's why we have to. That's why we have this special circumstance. They found an offer was made. They found a binding promise was made. They can't find promissory estoppel without finding that he made a binding promise to her that she had the job. That was what they found induced her to relinquish the other job. So, yes, that was one of the defenses, and that's why I said this is particularly ironic, because on the one hand, they're saying, well, we made the offer, but we really didn't make it in the right way, so therefore it really wasn't an offer, and we didn't make an offer. So it's a very circular catch-22 type of reasoning that I believe, and somewhat cynical, the state is engaged in. The jury found an offer was made. She reasonably relied on the offer. The offer was in reckless disregard of the truth at the moment that it was made. It induced her reliance to her detriment, and the rules say this offer was made in total violation of the policy as they themselves admit. So they can't have it both ways, and they must abide by that finding of the jury, because it's that finding of fact so important and so critical, so fundamental to this case. I think that I've been talking about and maybe that's, I do see this as the critical issue. We differentiated this case again from Willow Creek. I think Willow Creek is an important case. I think there was some division in this court in terms of what should happen with regard to Willow Creek. But I think Justice Prosser spoke rather eloquently at the end whether or not that case met on a factual basis the requisites he intended to serve. But in looking at discretionary immunity, we have Justice Prosser's dissent saying the real world cannot function if citizens are not able to rely on individualized decisions of authoritative government officials. Here we had, unlike Willow Creek, an authoritative governmental official who was responsible for the process, not a potential maverick member of a zoning board where everyone should reasonably know the board has to make some sort of a decision. This is a person who is saying, it's my decision, I'm making it, I'm offering you the job. And if you don't know that I'm violating university rules and policies in so doing, and I therefore can renege on this offer later on after you have relinquished your opportunity, tough luck. And she didn't know. She had a reason to rely on that person who represented himself to be authoritative, and indeed who was authoritative, but who simply violated the guidelines for making such an offer. Had he made the offer, and we can reason back on this, Justice Babich, had he made the offer in accordance with the guidelines, it would be a contract action. It would be binding. As such, he did not. He made that personally representing himself to be acting on behalf of the university, and he made it outside the guidelines and outside the specific directive he was given as to how to make offers.
The misrepresentation claim in this case is gone.
That's correct.
So we're here only on the promissory estoppel.
That's correct.
Which you prevailed upon in front of the jury.
Right.
And that is an action that sounds in contract. Is it not?
Well, it's defined, it's, and that's an interesting point, Justice Sykes, because I was looking over Judge Rogensack's dissent. It's their point. It sounds in contract. Yes, it does sound in contract. It has almost all of the considerations that a contract action has, but it isn't a contract action. It is some sort of a hybrid, which has been called a tort or a quasi-contract, etc. But it is an action, a special equitable action brought against the individual who makes the promise.
It's not a tort.
Well, it has been referred to as a tort or quasi-tort in some of the literature that has been written about promissory estoppel. Indeed, it is a unique kind of cause of action because it's defined to a great extent by the damage it causes. For instance, a contract action, if this was strictly contract action, we would be seeking those damages for the lost job at the University of Wisconsin, say, she didn't get paid the money that was paid there. Here we're seeking the reliance damages.
Right. It doesn't give contract damages, nor does it create a contract by operation of law. So I understand that, but it fairly universally, I think, is referred to as a cause of action that sounds in contract, not a tort, whatever that means, and does not constitute a tort for purposes of punitive damages and other sorts of things that go along with tort law. And the reason I ask that is because it may or may not make a difference. I think it probably does make a difference on the analysis of the immunity issue.
I think it does make a difference precisely, and this is what I was getting at, and I lost my path a little bit here. If you look at Judge Rogensack's opinion, and she's saying, really, this is a contract action, and I'm going to hold you to a contract action even though it's not a contract action. But if we looked at it as a contract action, because all the elements were there, there would be no immunity. Because within the ambit of a contract action, there is an offer, there is an acceptance, there is a commitment, and it is viewed as a ministerial duty. In Major, for example, it is therefore a ministerial duty to complete the contract, to follow on your promise. That is viewed as ministerial. If it isn't indeed a literal contract action, I'm sorry, my time is up, so just finish this if you'd allow me. If it isn't indeed a contract action, technically speaking, but it has all of those protections about you have a definite and certain type of duty as you would in a contract, then the reasoning should also follow that there shouldn't be discretionary immunity once you've made a clear, binding promise which somebody accepts. And you intend to have them to accept to their detriment. So it has really all of those indicia of contract which exceeds discretionary immunity. If I could, I'd like to reserve some time, I guess.
Yes. Counsel, thank you, Counsel, and you do have 5 minutes for it. Assistant Attorney General John Sweeney, representing Thomas Sadula and the W. Board of Regents.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is John Sweeney. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I represent Dr. Thomas Sadula in this action. An initial point, Judge DeShambo indicated that the Board of Regents was included as a party solely for the purposes of if liability was found against Dr. Sadula, that based on indemnification, that the Board of Regents would, in fact, pay any judgment. Justice Bradley's question, what is at issue in this case? And I think the issue in this case is, did Dr. Bickneys at any stage of this litigation demonstrate that one of the exceptions to public official immunity applies. I mean, this was something that was waived or highlighted early on in the litigation. It was a matter for summary judgment, at which time Judge DeChambeau was very, very clear to the plaintiff that they have survived summary judgment in part, but once all the facts are revealed, the court will decide whether or not there was willful, intentional, and malicious. Now, Judge DeChambeau used both the conjunctive and the disjunctive. To answer Justice Sykes' questions, is this in fact a contract? This case was not litigated as a contract. In fact, the only time that it came up at the trial court level was after Judge DeChambeau had made a ruling on the immunity issue. Ms. Pennelly asked the court if she could say something to the court and then wanted to renew a motion that this was in fact a contract. Had that been done, obviously, as we indicated briefly in our brief, there are certain prerequisites in order to bring a contract action against the state, and I believe there's no doubt in this case that those prerequisites were not followed. Judge DeChambeau pointed out very clearly in this litigation that there are two possible exceptions to public official immunity in this case, and this was at the summary judgment stage. One, and he found that there were no ministerial duties whatsoever in this case, and that's a finding that the Court of Appeals repeated. They said the plaintiff has failed to show at any point in time that there's any ministerial duty. In fact, all of those duties that we've been talking about, that Mr. Fox has discussed with you, he is referring to the university regulations. I'd ask the court, very frankly, look at those university regulations. Justice Bradley, the one you were looking at, talk about an appointment. And I would suggest to you that discussion of the university regulations, because they talk about an appointment, were never a clear, specific duty for Dr. Sutula. They speak in terms of at the time of the appointment, you must clearly set forth what the rules are regarding tenure. What we had in this case, if you will, is an extended period of negotiations. Obviously, there are some differences to what Dr. Sutula said, and we are bound by the jury verdict. The jury verdict said, yes, in fact, Dr. Sutula told Dr. Vicknes, in effect, you have a job. We yet have no appointment by the university. When we talk about public official immunity, as opposed to municipal immunity, immunity is the rule. Liability is the exception. That's very different from the standard when we talk about municipal immunity. In that case, it's completely the opposite. In terms of Willow Creek, talking about a public policy exception may well be a good idea for municipal immunity. Will it solve all the problems? I don't think so. But I don't think we reached that in this particular case because we're talking about public official immunity, not municipal.
Council, I need your assistance in making sure I have the issues with this year. When we want to decide something that's not an issue, I have to try to analyze it. I want to get back to, is it your position this case was tried as a tort?
Yes.
In fact, damages included emotional
pain and suffering, yes it did. Two torts.
Two torts, yes. And when you say two torts, what are you referring to?
There was intentional misrepresentation on which obviously the defendant prevailed, promissory estoppel, on which based on the jury instructions, the plaintiff prevailed. However, if you take the one question talking about intent, that was part of the jury verdict in the intentional misrepresentation. Did Dr. Satula intend to deceive? The jury obviously answered, no, he did not.
As I saw this case preparing for it, I saw it tried as a tort in the Court of Appeals. You're looking specifically at your brief. It didn't seem to in any way contest that this was a tort action.
That's correct.
And when the petition for review was filed, that was not presented as an issue, whether or not it was a tort action or contract. And yet I see on page 19 of your brief here, the argument, alternatively, if the complaint sounds in contract. And that causes me to pause, because I say, whoa.
The first time that issue arose, obviously, was with the concurrence at the Court of Appeals. And we at least treated that summarily, if you will. If this court is going to consider Justice or Judge Rogensack's opinion, then we provide those comments. But that does not say that it was not filed as a tort, tried as a tort, and considered to be torts.
And appealed as a tort.
Yes. Yes, Justice.
I understand that's what everybody was sort of assuming in the courts below, with the exception of Judge Rogensack, but wouldn't it be a pretty big deal for this court to say in this case that an action in promissory estoppel in the state of Wisconsin is a tort action?
Well, I don't know if it's necessary for you even to get there, or call it what you will, it is not a contract.
We have to characterize this cause of action in order to analyze the immunity defense, don't we? Both the public officer immunity defense based on discretionary versus ministerial acts, as well as any sovereign immunity issues that are present.
It is a tort. Sovereign immunity is not an issue, as the board is here only, as does Judge DeChambeau said, in the event that there is liability and they would then reimburse Dr. Satula. It's not here on an issue of liability. If you look at the trial court decision, the board was dismissed with that exception.
On what grounds?
That it had sovereign immunity.
And the public officer doesn't partake in that sovereign immunity to the extent that this is a contract claim?
Well, that was never dealt with, as I said.
Right. I think it needs to be, and that's why I'm asking the question.
If it is a contract claim, as Justice Babelich said, there's no personal jurisdiction insofar as the board is concerned.
And was that raised on Dr. Satula's behalf in the courts below?
I don't believe so. I don't believe it was presented and not, consequently not provided, responded to.
And therefore is waived or is not waived?
If it's not presented, it's not an issue that has to be defended against, Justice Sykes.
So it is waived?
No, it is not. It was not an issue. If it is a contract action against the state, then there's no personal jurisdiction, as Justice Babbage said, because the claim was not presented to the legislature.
And doesn't that have to be asserted as a defense in the court below in order to be addressed?
Only if a contract claim is raised. There are a number of other claims that could have been raised. They weren't.
I know this wasn't litigated as a breach of contract.
Correct.
I understand the reasons for that. And I'm not suggesting that promissory estoppel creates a contract, but as a very threshold matter, we have to decide what promissory estoppel is and is not for purposes of getting to all of the other issues.
If it speaks so well of a contract, personal jurisdiction is required. It's incumbent upon the plaintiff to establish that there is, in fact, personal jurisdiction.
But is personal jurisdiction a defense that has to be asserted?
No, it has to be established by the plaintiff. And until it is, the court can, of its own accord, dismiss any claim.
Well, your position has to be pleaded.
Yes, yes,
Justice. The plaintiff, before it has to be...
The plaintiff has to establish personal jurisdiction on any kind of issue.
Is it your position that this case can be decided without tackling that issue?
Yes.
And If you were going to write the opinion, how would you write this opinion? How would you decide it without tackling that issue?
I would treat it much as the Court of Appeals did in their decision, and I would add that this august body has, since the time of Lister, firmly held to the ministerial discretionary distinction, and there is nothing in this or any other record which would cause this court to deviate at all from the willful, intentional, and malicious standard that it has used from the time of Lister. And as informative as Judge Rogensack's opinion is, I don't think we need to go there. Again, if there are no further questions, our position is, and it's been our position from the time this case was filed, it is the plaintiff's duty to establish that one of the elements of immunity applies to this case. There were two possibilities at the trial court level. The plaintiff was given a forecast by the trial judge as to what she must do at trial. The jury came back, jury verdict number 7, said very clearly, did Dr. Sotula intend to deceive? The answer was no. And that, for the trial court and for the Court of Appeals, was sufficient to say, therefore, Dr. Sotula is entitled to public official immunity for all of his actions, which, frankly, were very, very discretionary. There's nothing, and you were correct, Justice Bradley, in quoting the ministerial formula, if you will. There's nothing in this record that shows that his duty was, you shall negotiate this way, you shall put forward an offer this way. The university regulations that Mr. Fox is talking to you about, if you will read them carefully, state upon appointment. Upon appointment. This was not a case of appointment, this was a case of negotiation.
What did the doctor do wrong here, the plaintiff do wrong?
We understand when we're dealing with public official immunity that we presume negligence. What Dr. Sotula did wrong, if I
know. What did the other party do wrong? McNeese.
Dr. McNeese? Let me start with Dr. Sotula. Dr. Sotula should have checked out whether he could get a 3-year, 4-year, or a 5-year tenure plan for Dr. McNeese. Dr. McNeese should have, on the other hand, said, I want it in writing, because I know nothing is good until I get it in writing. So if you will, both of them should have had a little more foresight as to, am I going to leap from a job in New York, job in Buffalo, before I have an offer in hand? And as Justice Bablich said, there was no written offer in hand. They were drafts. As Dr. Sotula testified, they were working negotiation documents.
Now, you're saying that there was not an offer?
The jury found there was an oral offer. There was a promise made by Dr. Sotula. There was none, Justice Brasso, a written offer.
Did the jury find there was an oral offer?
It didn't distinguish between oral or written.
They just found there was an offer.
There was an offer, and obviously based on what went on at the trial, no one contended that there was a written document signed, which the candidate then signs in return. There was nothing like that. It was, as Dr. Sotula said, negotiations. This was the basis on which I hoped to pursue Dr. McNeese's candidacy.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite getting this. If the jury found there was an offer, what is the consequence of that?
Absent public official immunity, the jury would have prevailed. I'm sorry, the plaintiff would have prevailed on promissory estoppel. Absent the finding that there was no willful, intentional, and malicious intent on the part of Dackerson to what the plaintiff would have recovered on promissory estoppel?
Nothing. No duties flow from the fact that there was an offer made?
Dr. Satula continues to suggest that he was negotiating. And obviously the jury found that Dr. McNeese believed that there was an offer and there was in fact an offer. But Dr. Satula, not having sent the appointment letter, not having confirmed the offer in writing, there's nothing further for him to do except to pursue with the university committee to see if he could get an extension of Dr. McNeese's tenure. And unfortunately for all, he was unsuccessful in that.
As I look at the special verdict, maybe this is not the consequence, but I pointed out, I don't see the jury answering the question, was there a job offer? They answered that the defendant promised the plaintiff a job, so to the extent that you construe that to mean that there was a job offer, the only language with regard to job offer I see, and I may be mistaken, but is on question 3, did defendant reject the job offer from Buffalo based on the defendant's representations?
I think by using the term offer, I said, was there a promise of a job? And I think that the jury answered that right off the bat. And if I misspoke in terms of an offer, that was certainly my thinking.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Justice.
Any other questions? Mr. Fox, you have 5 minutes.
Just quickly addressing the issue of personal jurisdiction and who should raise it and when, I think it's black-letter law, as a matter of fact, it's written in the statute, that lack of personal jurisdiction is an affirmative defense and should be raised or it's waived. I don't think there's anything a plaintiff can do other than bring the lawsuit, submit to the personal jurisdiction of the court, have them submit to the personal jurisdiction of the court, and not wait until it gets up to the Supreme Court and say there wasn't personal jurisdiction. And plaintiffs should have fought themselves on the issue. So I don't think that's an acceptable position in that particular issue. There was, our laws control that. It's difficult. Once again, we have to stick to the facts of the case because the case is to some extent being factually retried here, but really quickly going down the verdict. And the special verdict is important. Did defendant promise plaintiff a job at the University of Wisconsin? Question number 1, yes. Did defendant reasonably expect the promise would induce plaintiff to reject the offer from Buffalo? Yes. If you have answered question number 2, yes, did defendant reject the job offer from Buffalo? That's representation? Yes. And question number 4, Justice Bradley, if the word offer isn't used, says, did defendant make representations of fact that plaintiff had a job at the University of Wisconsin Medical School? Answer, yes. Now, I don't know how anything could get more certain than the answers to these questions in terms of what was done at the time. He wasn't representing that he was in negotiations. He wasn't representing that there was something further to be done. There was a contingency somewhere out there that had to be resolved. He said, you have that job here at the university, and in so doing, he violated the appointment rule, which says you can't make an offer like that unless you do it in accordance with appointment rule.
And that was my first question that I asked you about the doctor discretionarily or puffery or whatever you want to call it. Does it make a difference whether it was written or oral?
It does not make a difference at all.
At this point, it doesn't.
The one difference that it does make is that when he does it outside of the strict mandate of the university rules, and they say, you've got to make it in writing, only he knows that. There was some suggestion Dr. McNeese should know what is required of him at the university. Well, that's nonsense. She can't know that. She's got to deal with that official who is the key running point for the university, clothed with the authority of the university, saying, you have a job here. Done deal. Nothing else to be done. That's it. And on that basis, and knowing at the time that he makes that representation, by the way, that she's going to be taxed this opportunity she has at Buffalo. But further in this verdict, I think it's helpful to look at this in terms of the immunity question, and that's that, were such representations untrue? Answer, yes. Question number six, if you've answered question number five, yes, then answer this question. Did defendant make representations knowing they were untrue or recklessly without caring whether they were true or untrue? Answer, yes. Now, what we have here, Justice Sykes, maybe is a little bit of a super promissory estoppel case in the sense I don't think that question ordinarily would be posed in most promissory estoppel cases. But what we did show was a higher degree of egregious conduct on his part, that he simply didn't care whether he said what he said was true, and he didn't care whether he was abiding by the regulation.
Well, let me follow up on that. When I read that special verdict question, I assumed that that was part of the elements of an intentional misrepresentation claim, not a promissory estoppel claim, along with the one that follows in question number seven, which pertains to the intent to deceive.
The way you can reconcile those two claims, I think, is a fairly logical one. What the jury recognized is that he wanted her to come to the university. He wanted her, he intended for her to come to the university. So he wasn't deceiving her in the sense that he was misrepresenting that he wanted her to come and get the job. That wasn't a misrepresentation. The jury was smart enough to parse out, however, when he made the reckless representation he did, you have a job, that he was at that point in reckless disregard of the truth. That he knew, he had some knowledge. He still intended to get her the job, but he had some knowledge that she didn't have, that there were other procedures he needed to go through and other authority he needed to get in order to make that a truthful offer.
Right, but that's part of the misrepresentation claim, not part of the promissory estoppel claim.
No, it was asked as there was a separate special verdict form. This was part of the promissory estoppel claim. This was asked as part of that claim. That's why the jury answered yes to that. And on a separate jury verdict form related to the misrepresentation claim, they said he didn't intend to deceive. So in the context of the promissory estoppel claim, they made that finding.
There's two special verdicts in this case?
Yes.
What do you do with question number seven on the special verdict that's on appendix page 25, which is if you've answered question six yes, then answer this question. Did defendant make representations with intent to deceive?
Excuse me, I misspoke. There are not two. Well, the way I reconcile those two statements is that clearly he didn't have intent. He was in reckless disregard of the truth. That's how you can reconcile those two. There's a difference between intending to deceive, a specific intent to deceive, and not caring whether or not the representations you make are true.
There were not two special verdicts.
No, there weren't, and I misspoke. I'm sorry.
Was a negligent misrepresentation claim made in this case?
It was not.
Okay, so we've got an intentional misrepresentation claim
correct.
And a promissory estoppel
that's
claim.
Correct.
And there's one verdict form.
Correct.
And the intentional misrepresentation claim failed because question seven was answered no.
That's true.
All we have is promissory estoppel.
The promissory estoppel claim and the answers they gave to support that claim.
Any other questions? Apparently not. Mr. Fox, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sweeney, thank you. Both of you did an excellent job. That concludes the arguments in case number 001825. The court will be in recess until 1:45 this afternoon.